Welcome to Spark Your Fire Podcast, sparking your interest in Australian property and finance. Here's your hosts, Jazz and David.
G'day everyone, welcome back to another episode of Spark Your Fire. I'm your host, David Shee, and we've got our usual host, Jazz, here with us. Jazz, how are you doing?
I am good, mate. I'm happy that the schools are opening up finally. I love my kids. Finally, I'll be able to at least send them to school so I can get a little bit of space.
You look relieved. Let's put it that way. You look relieved.
I sure am.
In comparison to a few weeks ago, you were like, oh my God, you just came back from a war.
Teaching kids is like a war.
Yeah. Well, I can understand. It's a civil war every day. Let's put it that way. Inside a home.
You are lucky, mate. You didn't have kids during this coronavirus time. I wish you should take one of mine.
when it's my turn, I'm sure you'll dig me hard. Let's put it that way. So been there, done it. Good luck. That kind of stuff. But that's good. Yeah, as you mentioned, I think New South Wales and Victoria are all easing, and I'm sure Queensland as well. And on that note, that's why it's also been a few weeks since we released a special episode about the proposed Queensland-Tennessee protection reform. And as such, I think it will be good to do a follow-up on that because I know that made the news and that made the headlines at that time. Lots of people have been posting about it to say, look, these are the things that is being proposed. And I'm sure a lot of Queensland landlords are very interested to know what has happened in the end with the legislation. So that's why we brought our lovely Tom again back on the show. G'day, Tom. How are you?
Morning, all. How are you? Good, good.
Yeah, excellent.
Welcome back, Tom.
As always, yes. So that's why we had our Tom back because, you know, he obviously gave a good insight last time about what the impact is should those 6 points has actually been legislated. And now it's a matter of actually following through to say what has actually happened. So I guess without any further delay, Tom, let's just jump into based on those 6 points that we had last time, you know, let's talk about them just to give our audience a bit of update on what has happened since our last conversation and what has eventually been legislated, you know, and what Queensland landlords should probably know in the current environment. Okay. So just to kick off, I guess, we mentioned one of the biggest points was your tenants will not have to pay back any rent. That was one of the proposed reforms at that time. So what has happened to this point?
Well, look, to start with, most of the reforms came back really reasonable. They listened. They made them fair and balanced. This one, when you phrase it that way, technically still that's a possibility. So there's a new process in place, and I risk answering this question in not so concisely, but it's a new process called a show cause notice. It doesn't replace the Form 11 notice to remedy breach, but it slots in before it. So when a tenant is 7 clear days in arrears, we issue them this show cause notice. They have 14 days to provide evidence, basically saying this is why we're behind in rent. It's because of COVID, and here's all our documentation why. And I've just given you a hint to the answer of one of the next questions as well. That's been brilliant. That means that if tenants are genuinely in trouble, they're able to substantiate that, and then they can come back to the landlord to discuss the situation. If they're not able to come to an agreement there, they go to the RTA. If not there, they'll go to tribunal. I'm fortunate enough not to have anything that's entering mediation, so I can't talk on how that process is at the moment, but I am told that it's seriously delayed. The guideline is that tenants are supposed to pay something around 30% of their remaining income as rent. I have some personal feelings on the matter. I think based on average rents in capital areas compared to average incomes, 30% is going to be significantly lower than what people are paying regardless of their previous income and current income now. So I can't stress enough for a lot of people that there is an incentive to negotiate with the tenants and work with them, because if you do end up in front of tribunal, it's likely you will end up with a worse result. And my understanding is that even if the tribunal takes 9 months down the line, obviously you're going to have someone unhappy there for a long time and potentially end up having to give money back if they keep making an effort or not be receiving money through that whole period. So it's really, it's not likely to be a win-win. Probably one of the biggest issues with this whole setup right now is the delay. They're simply not able to hear all the cases in a timely manner. And that's, I won't blame the Australian government. I think that's pretty typical of any sort of bureaucratic system, is that they're just not agile enough to add the capacity that they need when they need it.
Yeah.
So to answer the questions from the start, yes, you can be. If you ended up in a tribunal situation, you could be forced to offer a rent reduction, not a rent deferral. But there's plenty of situations prior to that to negotiate an alternative resolution.
Yeah. Okay. So the ground there is basically, it's not a blanket rule to say the tenant will not have to pay anything, just, because essentially that's what's been proposed previously. Now it's more back into reason to go, right, if you are seriously being and truly being impacted by COVID-19, then there's guidelines as such to say, but that is that 30% legislated or is that just a guideline? If you take it to tribunal and, you know, in the end, is that the ruling to go, right, they are being impacted and therefore, you know, on both sides when the ruling comes down, you know, landlord, you have to swallow this, you know, maximum 30%. Is that what it's going to be end up with?
Welcome to tribunal where there's no such thing as a ruling, only guidelines. It really is a guideline, but it's okay. Ultimately down to the tribunal member at the time to consider the facts put forward to them and make a decision on that basis. So on one hand, you'd like to have faith in the system and think that that would ensure a fair and reasonable result, but it also means that it's difficult to predict the result.
Mm. What do you reckon, Jazz?
So I was going to ask, actually, Tom, I was curious to know how many cases within your agency or within your network, how many cases have you seen where people have actually asked for rent reduction?
I've had a few ask, but if we whittle down to those who have substantiated, so far one. I'm expecting one to two more in the next couple of months. Admittedly, people have been tardy on this, but I've had one who substantiated his case and been awarded a rent reduction. This was a really good example of one that was a positive negotiation, because the tenant actually asked for a reduction from 310 to 250, and based on his income of 550, that's significantly higher than the 30% that the guidelines would suggest he should have asked for, which I believe from memory was around 180 a week. So the landlord was actually really happy with that result. I put forward some suggestions as to other alternative options, and he came back and said, look, I think it's fair. Let's drop it to the 250 a week for the foreseeable future. We'll put a solid end date of it of the 31st of September, which seems to be the day that the Queensland government says COVID will go away. But if his situation changes sooner, then obviously that rent reduction will change. And we've also discussed further renewals, a potential rent increase in exchange for a security screen door, et cetera. So that's been bundled in with some positive negotiations beyond COVID-19 as well.
How would you guys go about the 30% reduction? So are you guys in this particular case that you're talking about, was this before or after?
He only substantiated last week, and he didn't ask for the full reduction to 30% of his income. I think the 250 came somewhere around 45%, and the tenant asked for that straight off the bat. There was no need to negotiate over the amount there, which was really good. It's nice to see as well, on both sides of things, parties being reasonable about their requests.
Mm-hmm. Because I at one point was honestly concerned that the people will try and misuse the system a little bit over here, where they will start asking for reductions. But it sounds like nothing like that has happened so far,
I think there's a huge amount of opportunity to try and take advantage of this system. And I think anything that has to be brought into effect rapidly in a situation like this, it is unavoidable. So again, no criticism to the lawmakers here. But certainly in areas with higher rents, higher average rents. Obviously, JobKeeper is fixed at $750 a week, JobSeeker at $550. So for me, with an average rent of a little over $300 a week, one to two people can still afford their rent. If you're in eastern suburbs of Sydney and your $300,000 a year income is reduced to $30,000 a year overnight and your rent's $1,500 a week, you're in a serious situation there. And obviously that's a bit of an extreme example, and there's everything in the middle. But certainly other agents, particularly in those higher income areas, are seeing more cases of more difficult negotiations where the landlord and the tenant are not able to come to an agreement, because in some of those cases you're talking about $500 or $600 a week wiped off the rent, which is an astronomical amount of money.
Yeah, I think you hit nail on the head. It's the JobKeeper and the Seeker package. Till that's there, I don't see it to be getting too bad. But when they start wrapping that up a little bit, it will be interesting to see how things go. And that's where there may be a little bit of a drama that will happen.
I think if you ask some different agents, you'd get a different response there. I think we've been combination of being a smaller agency with a good relationship with the tenants, and also admittedly just being in an affordable area. We've really, touch wood, escaped the brunt of what some other agents are experiencing. Mel Morgan down in Sydney would be a really good person to talk to for another perspective there.
Right. So here's the question for you. At what point do you guys go back to chase on the rent increase again? I mean, how do you guys go about that? Is there any guideline on that, or how would you go about doing that?
The end of September is the guideline date for when COVID disappears. Obviously, it's a placeholder because we don't know. There could be another outbreak. It could not have an outbreak. We could be like New Zealand and have eradicated it, if you believe their politicians. I believe at this stage it looks like they may have. So we might end up in the same situation and be able to open up sooner, in which case those discounts will come to end sooner than expected. So it's really a sort of play it by ear situation there. But certainly for us, we have been... Actually, I shouldn't say we have been. On that one situation that we've had so far with the discount, we did put an end date on it of the end of September or sooner if practical. If we get to September and there's some sort of need for that to be extended, then we'd renegotiate at the time.
That's what I was trying to understand. If there's a legal agreement or contract being put in place that says it's up until the end of September or whatever the month is, to renegotiate after that if required.
Yeah, there's been some new official forms drafted to allow for temporary rent reductions without having to redraft leases, which has been good for us, less admin work and less anxiety over whether we're filling things out correctly.
The landlord is not obviously going to get any relief in this case. I mean, they can suspend their mortgage, but the reality is the interest is going to get capitalized on the interest. It's a pain for the landlord, so it's a very interesting time. There is no talk about this rent, the shortfall being repaid, the negotiated rent to be repaid in future by the tenant.
It'll depend on the situation. So with this one example I have, there was no discussion about it being repaid in the future, and I think the indication is that the authorities would strongly prefer to avoid a rent deferral. I personally think this isn't particularly fair, because as a landlord, you can defer your payments, but you can't have them paid for you for the next 6 months. So I think it's unfair for on the shoe on the other foot is that they get a discount ultimately that doesn't ever have to be paid back. And there's a number of arguments both ways there. I'm not going to say which way is right or wrong. Certainly our preference would be to discuss a rent deferral to start with. I have a few tenants who are behind right now or have been behind in April who have been lucky enough to have their payments increased now. Some people have taken their super out, and for anyone who's watching, that was not at my urging. It is illegal for us to ask tenants to take the super out. But that's, you know, that was sort of one way that we organised a rent deferral. I discussed with tenants that if they worked with me throughout this situation and we got to the other side of it and we were able to pay off the debt, then I would wipe the notices from their file for this period. So basically telling people that, and this isn't a thing that's been a guideline, this is how we decided to deal with it. I've been telling my tenants, look, work with us. Don't panic when you get these notices. If you keep working with us, these notices will go away when it comes time that everything comes back. So people aren't stressing and panicking, thinking, oh, my God, my rental history is falling apart here. Mm. And that's really important for people who are doing the right thing, that they're not negatively affected by that, because we're looking at surviving this situation now, but we're also looking at limiting the fallout on the other side. And I have had a couple of tenants who at first have not worked so well with us on the matter, but the vast majority is that everyone has been really good to deal with. I think they respond. It's a people business. ScoMo pointed out that it's time for everyone to sit down as people and work together on this, and as much as possible, that's what we're trying to do. Yeah. And at the same time, obviously, we do work for our clients, so we're trying to create a business-as-usual situation as much as possible where rent keeps getting paid and we move on without sort of any loss to either party.
Yeah, I think,
and, you know, you're looking for that win-win for everyone, really.
Yeah, I think it would be interesting to see. I mean, if there is not many reductions, then I guess it makes less of a case. But otherwise, it will be interesting because landlords still have to make their repayments, and they are obviously not going to get reduced. You can temporarily suspend it, but it's not that you're not paying that interest. You still have to pay the interest. So it will be very interesting to see what a lot of landlords' opinions are. I mean, what do you think, David? You've got a few properties up there.
Oh, luckily I don't. I think I'm in one of those lucky ones, which I don't have much being impacted so far, to be honest. So, I don't think any of my tenants have actually asked for rent reduction to date. Essentially, it's either just, life goes on as is, they've just been paying. But I understand there's a lot of unfortunate landlord that has, as you pointed out, has had to cop the rent reduction, and while they still need to keep paying the mortgage, but luckily, the mortgage repayments at the moment, because of the low interest rate, it's also a lot easier to hold. So, you know, I think it's difficult to see that it's going to be a complete win-win on both sides. In this case, you know, as Tom pointed out, it has to be something that, you know, you just got to understand. If you're investing in property, there's always going to be in good days, there's always going to be rainy days. And that's why we've always been an advocate to say you need to have a rainy day fund buffer. And this is where that rainy day buffer time is going to come in, because ultimately, yes, this is going to be a dip and you are going to suffer as a consequence as a landlord. But ultimately, in a few years' time, you know, like after things go back in normal, we can have our rental income back as before. Yeah.
One thing in favor of the landlords, obviously, is the rate reductions that happened that have reduced the repayments at the same time too. So you can say that there's some stuff that is in favor of the landlords too, to be fair. I mean, the whole situation is a funny one. But in reality, it's just really you need to wait for the data to come out to be able to tell properly what how badly the impact is going to be, because a lot of the landlords may have already suspended the repayments, thinking that they're going to have to reduce the rent or that their property is not going to be tenanted anymore. So it's the data probably is lagging. We'll probably have to wait a couple of months before it comes out, and then the job keeper, job seeker, when they disappear. So it's just a wait and see what happens.
Yeah, it's a bit difficult to comment at this point in time without the full set of data. And we know that's a lagging indicator. So, All right, moving along. I guess the second point, which I think you've kind of answered in your previous response, Aurel, you cannot ask your tenants for any proof of financial hardship. So at the moment, it sounds like that's already being addressed.
You absolutely can. And there's no detrimental limitations on that. The tenants really, if they need a discount or some sort of other consideration, they do need to provide substantiation of that. And it was pointed out as well that we're able to and entitled to ask for those sorts of documents before they move into the house. So there's really no change in their privacy or rights in asking for it now. And certainly we're bound by the same privacy laws and same disclosure with this information as we were with any others. So I think that was a really good win for that.
Or is that like bank statements to show that the salary credit has taken a hit? Or how is that being proved?
It's a bit different for everyone. So, for example, the gentleman that I've had go through has showed me a Centrelink income statement, which gives us a lot of information, tells you how much you're receiving, implies that there's no more work, for example, if someone's receiving the full amount of JobKeeper. And we also got a letter from the employer stating that the employment was temporarily not proceeding. Also, importantly, that they were not eligible for JobKeeper. Everyone's going to be a little bit different. For example, one of my staff members' parents are self-employed and runs a really cute little shop down in Boona. And that's that. If they were tenants, would be a much more difficult way to substantiate the loss in income. Some small businesses, their income disappeared overnight. Unfortunately, that would be really easy for them to show that they have no income at all anymore. So it's really, most of them will be clear cut, but other cases it's, you know, it may be a letter from your accountant, income statement, different pay slips, letter from the employer. There's a bit of everything there. And the COVID show cause letter doesn't limit that, so that it does allow us and tenants to substantiate in the best way that they can with the documents that they need.
Gotcha. Okay. No, that's good. That's definitely a win, because previously it just doesn't make any logical sense at all. Cool. Yeah. All right. So looking at the next point then, landlord insurance will not cover you for rent in arrears.
We still don't have a good answer for this.
Okay. So that's still a maybe.
They're all coming back and saying it's case by case, and I completely understand why. I have heard people who've had different answers from the landlord's insurers about things that are and aren't covered. Certainly the RAIQ sought to have the regulations or the reforms put through in a way so that would have minimal impact to the landlord's insurance. So, for example, I have heard, and I need to confirm, that some insurers are able to pay out on rent loss prior to an eviction, which is a new thing. And that's something I had been asked about by clients who say, what if my tenant stops paying rent for 6 months? I can't survive without 6 months rent waiting for that claim. Unfortunately, I'm not the right person to talk to about that in more detail. But my understanding overall is that if you do offer a rent discount, that won't be covered by landlord's insurance. If you can imagine, you've effectively volunteered to reduce the rent. I would be curious to know if an adjudicator enforced a rent reduction, whether there would be any consideration as to whether that would be covered. Again, I can't give that advice. It's a bit of a hard time with that. Something that is also really interesting is that, to my knowledge, the insurers are all on an embargo for offering some of them their entire landlord's insurance policies, and others just excluding certain components such as rent default. And then there's situations where if you're an existing client, you may be able to get a new policy. Certainly, as far as I know, every insurer is honoring renewals. But it is certainly for someone who's entering the market for the first time as an investor and bringing their property, taking out those insurances, et cetera, or someone who's decided now's a high risk time, I need to take the insurance out. There are some limitations there for what that covers. And you might just want to pass that on to your property manager and consider the risk profile of your property and the tenants that you're looking at accepting for it, for the fact that you may not have the full coverage that you might have otherwise had.
Yeah. So I guess I think I'm on the same line with you there. Basically, I think the insurers themselves are still working this out as well, in terms of how the impact of the 4 hours is going to be, what they will cover, what they won't cover. A lot of them's already stopped offering new landlord insurances at this point in time because it's still a work in progress piece. As such, I think, would your recommendation be, I guess, for the individuals to directly seek specific advice from the insurer in terms of what's covering and what will not be covered with the new insurance policy that is about to be taken out, absolutely. So they understand the indications, the ins and outs, right?
Yeah, the advice I've been given very specifically is that it's taken case by case. But even then, I'd be aware as an individual, you may not be able to get a really clear answer on your first phone call either, but it does not hurt to try.
Mm, Okay, so that's a grey area at the moment. I think that's we
sorry,
just have to wait on.
Sorry to any customer support networks who are about to get some phone calls.
Thanks to Tom. We'll make sure that's been noted down. All good. All right. So that one's a grey one, unfortunately. But we'll keep an eye on that as there's more updates coming through. The next one, your tenancy agreement will immediately extend by 6 months if it expires during the 6 months freeze on evictions.
This is a cool one. This is a really good example of where they balanced it. So anyone who can substantiate that they're COVID affected under that show cause notice is entitled to an extension to the end of September, back to that date. It's 6 months from the commencement of the reforms, roughly. So it's not 6 months from when they decide that they want the extension. If the tenant's lease already ends in, say, August, it's not 6 months from August. It's 6 months maximum to the end of September. I believe that's in place to stop landlords trying to push tenants out who are genuinely COVID affected and not able to cover their commitments. I think there are definitely just, this is a good example of one that could be taken advantage of and leave landlords in a situation where they have no income and are not able to remove the people. But I do think, and the small labor side of me thinks that they put this in place to protect people who are genuinely being preyed upon by agents and landlords who are trying to push them out the door too soon. That being said, it does seem somewhat unnecessary in that there is an embargo on evictions anyway. I guess it's probably there to close up some loopholes, but anyone who is COVID affected can't be evicted during this time anyway. So I guess it's a bit of a double layer of protection. And for landlords who are a bit with this particular component, I think you'd be more concerned over the overall inability to evict people who have properly substantiated that they're affected. And I can't stress enough, these tenants are only protected by these reforms if they make the effort to substantiate that they're affected. And that's important because, for example, I've had a couple of tenants who I think, and I don't have proof, and they're great people, but I think they looked at it and thought, you know what, that's too hard. I might just get my super out and keep paying my rent. So okay. Certainly, I don't think that that's the majority of people, but it is a good example of how it's made it fair and reasonable on both parties.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I think this is where the good property manager is going to be really, really helpful to help get to the right answers of whether it is a true case of extension required or not. Because
absolutely,
I think this. You guys are really going to shine this time on looking at some of these applications. Hopefully, you guys won't get many, but if you guys do, then dealing with them appropriately, obviously. So that's a very interesting one. But it's overall a funny situation. How you deal with it? It's yes, you want to protect the landlords because they have got mortgages, and then but at the same time, if people don't have options left. Because there has been a lot of unemployment, or if the situation gets bad, then how do you deal with it? It's the thing, right? So this is where you just need to assess the application carefully when it comes back for some of these modifications.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a big part of it, too, is looking at the overall situation. Going back to that example of the case that I've had, this is a great tenant who's likely to be long-term looking at signing a long lease. And the landlords considered that not only was it the compassionate thing to do, this is a business and we do represent your interests. So although we will put forward the compassionate option, ultimately our responsibility to you is to maximize your net return on investment. But in this particular case, it happened that those interests aligned. And I think there will be a lot of cases where that is the situation where he's considered that there is a loss now. I think we calculated it to be roughly just under $1,000. So it's more reduction than I would like to offer, but I think it was a really reasonable negotiation. And he's considering that long term, he has a fantastic tenant who takes great care of the house, who's probably going to be there a lot longer, who really trusts and appreciates him and won't be likely to move as a result. So from a business perspective, it made a lot of sense as well.
No, you're spot on that. It's really in the best interest of both the parties. It's trying to get the best outcome, obviously, that can be from the situation that the people are in. But what can you do? It is what it is. I can see the reason of why that has been put in place. I mean, as a landlord, I may be a little bit, if I had got the property in Queensland, I'll be a little bit like, you know what, it's not really reasonable. But then this is why you hire good property managers to help you out during these periods.
We're translators. It's part of our job to translate through any emotion and accept and consider both responses and help facilitate the right decision.
Yeah,
definitely.
Cool.
Okay. The next one is your tenants can refuse entry for anything other than emergency repairs. So that was an interesting one before.
Yeah. There's a couple of different... This was one that was changed dramatically based on what was proposed and what ended up coming into effect. As far as routine inspections, because that's the one that most affects me, the tenants are able to refuse access for a physical routine inspection, but they must then cooperate with a virtual routine inspection. This was a big thing for me because a lot of my tenants don't do video calls and a lot of them aren't really incentivized to learn how to do them. So if I wasn't able to compel them, as good as they are, I think I would have really struggled to say, hey, look, download Zoom or whatever application we ended up using. So it's good to say, look, you have to do this. You have to spend 5 minutes learning how to make a video call and take screenshots, et cetera, which has been great. So what we're doing is now that we're able to do that, we're organizing routine inspections by telling the tenants, you've got a choice. We'll either come and visit if you're not bothered and you don't want to learn how to do a video call, or we'll just video call. And I'm honestly expecting more people to prefer us to visit. Mm. I don't think there's a lot of fear around at the moment. I think that they trust that we're taking the hygiene precautions necessary. But I do think there will be other agencies where that proportion will be different. People around these sort of semi-regional areas tend to be pretty casual. So that will affect how we are able to operate. For other entry, for example, valuations for sale, building and pest inspections, my understanding is that they're not able to reasonably refuse access. If someone is COVID affected or highly vulnerable, it's different. So someone in the 70 plus age gap area, or someone who's come from overseas in the last 14 days or works as a nurse in a high risk area, those sorts of things are reasonable, and that's in normal legislation as well. You can reasonably provide refuse access. Mm-hmm. But for things like normal maintenance, again, the valuers, et cetera, the smoke alarms is a big one, smoke alarm compliance. We did have a few tenants saying we don't want you coming through. Yeah. And the smoke alarm providers advising us that they have not received any correspondence to suggest that their responsibility was changed. So that would have created a situation there where who's responsible if that house burns down and we weren't able to comply with those smoke alarms. That's all been able to go forward as normal, effectively. Ensuring, obviously, that all parties are taking every precaution necessary as far as things like wearing gloves and not touching things. To anyone who's going through open homes for inspection, please stop opening the wardrobes and the drawers and touching things unnecessarily. Oh, we leave it all open, don't touch. That's been a real pet hate recently. Again, come back to reasonable. And I think someone would have to be either particularly scared, vulnerable, or difficult to refuse access for any reason right now without a good reason.
Do you have to provide hand sanitizers before people walk in? It's like the supermarket.
You can get hand sanitizer and toilet paper again on all the shelves too.
I actually had a call from my property manager yesterday. They inspected the property virtually And I was like, oh, yeah, this is a new world we are in. Now we're going to get inspected virtually. And I was asking her what her experience was just doing a virtual inspection. Obviously, it's a little bit tricky, but they're trying to get used to it.
I don't really love them, and I put off doing them virtually. Not sort of, I mean, it was a busy time, but primarily because I just don't think it's anywhere near a replacement for a physical inspection. Certainly, it's better than nothing, but I mean, if I was a tenant and I had some stains on my carpet, I just won't show that.
Yeah.
And then the video, what's
that corner doing?
Yeah, our eyes are a very high resolution panoramic camera that you can't replace with an iPhone. So I've done a couple of these virtual inspections so far, and I haven't loved them because I just haven't been able to get a good feel for little things. But certainly, it does show that the house is still in one piece. It hasn't caught fire. It's not a complete bomb site. So it's better than nothing. And it is cool to see that we've been pushed into some new technology, or not new technology, but new processes to take advantage of the technology. I think we're very lucky this has happened now and not 30 years ago in respect to that.
I wouldn't be surprised that in future they just change it to that you have to use a HoloLens or a VR headset somehow to actually do a full-on virtual inspection rather than physically visiting the property and upsetting the tenants.
Immerse yourself in the virtual inspection process. Is that how it works?
Yeah. We made a couple of jokes about inspecting by drone. There's obviously some serious real-life issues with doing that, like, you know, flying a drone in someone's house. But
chance of that. Maybe you can inspect the roof with the drone and the structure is still there, but that's pretty much it.
Yeah, exactly. But look, so many possibilities. I'm a bit of a dinosaur myself. I'm always cautious to change things. So it's actually been really cool to have to do all of this.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, I already bought a webcam 6 months ago, so we were prepared.
But I mean, this one, on a serious note for this particular point, I mean, this is a very temporary one. It will, as things start to clear up, I mean, this is going to disappear, obviously. So it's a 6 month thing. So hopefully, and the inspections in Queensland are 3 months or 6 months. I forgot.
More often than every 13 weeks or 3 months. So
3 months.
I think Victoria, you're only allowed every 6 months, and I'm not entirely sure about New South Wales. I think they're also three
six
months.
Months. 6 months, I think.
In Victoria,
And there are some agents up here who do them less often, but the general expectation from clients is every 3 months. The majority of our tenants are great, and the three-month inspections seem a bit like deja vu. You go in, check everything's okay, catch up, play with the dog. But it is nice to know for people that you are maybe a little bit concerned about and wanting to keep an eye on, or houses that are in poor condition that you want to make sure that you're promptly getting onto maintenance.
Well, hopefully there will be only – so but if it's every 3 months, I mean, we'll hope for the best that there's only one or two inspections that will have to be done virtually before it changes anyways.
Absolutely. That's what I was putting off. I was thinking if this changes quickly, then I'll be able to go and do a physical inspection maybe 1 or 2 months late, as opposed to completely skipping a physical inspection.
Yeah.
As it's turned out, it's probably going to be about a 50-50, and I'm happy with that result. I really don't like the idea of not being able to see a property in person for more than 6 months. So hopefully it lets up soon. But at the same time, you know what? If this is a public health directive, and it would be really selfish of us to try and force our way into a house to see it in person when we're supposed to be social distancing. So I think they've struck a good balance here.
No, it's a temporary measure, like you said, you know, I'm sure. So let's keep an eye on what's happening in the next few months. But I still can't get over the September magical date that the COVID's going to go away. But anyway, that's another side story. So
that's a date, right?
All right, mate. Our last point. Your tenants can break lease with only 7 days notice.
Okay. There are new break lease measures in place, I believe, and I haven't had a case of this, so I haven't had to memorize it so well. So if anyone's listening and I do get something slightly wrong, I do apologize. But what I do know is that tenants are able to break lease. I believe it's with only 1 week's penalty maximum, which does invariably put the landlord out of pocket because there's generally 1 or 2 weeks of further vacancy. There's almost always a letting fee, if not advertising, and some like extra costs there. The tenants are still responsible for returning the property to the condition it was at entry. So it's not like you have to pay for their cleaners and repairs. But that's only relevant if the household has lost 75% or more income. So it's a different threshold to being COVID affected. It's a much higher threshold. Right. And it makes sense. I think it's primarily designed for people who have lost either their entire income, so one or two jobs, or their vastly main breadwinner. You know, mum could be receiving some family tax assistance living at home, so you might have lost, say, 90% of your income. And that's to help those people get out of there if they're potentially going to be stuck accruing a huge debt that they'd never be able to pay back. It's, you know, go live with family, friends, et cetera, for those people in the most severe circumstances. So I think that was a well-considered option. But admittedly, it is unfortunately a situation where landlords are legislated to a loss. And there's no compensation in that situation for landlords. So I think it's good for the people who are affected, but it's also a shame that the landlords are going to be forced out of pocket there if that was to occur.
So just so I understand, you're saying that they can only break the lease if they suffer 75% or more to their income?
They can only break their lease with the limit on compensation. They're welcome to break their lease at any time as normal. Okay. I've actually had three tenants break lease in the last month. But in that situation, it's the standard compensation applies. Tenants are effectively required to return the landlord to the same financial position they would have been in had they not broken lease. So a good one was we had a unit in the valley and the young tenant, lovely bloke, got stuck in China. And he ended up paying the rent reduction to the end of lease. His lease was August from memory. So we reduced the rent, multiplied that by the remaining weeks, and he's paid that. He's also paid rent. We actually limited that to 1 month to put his mind at ease. I was so confident I could have it rented in a month, and we did well under a month. And he also paid the let fee, which is the week's rent plus GST. So we mitigated his loss by securing new tenants as quickly as possible. And that was at the absolute worst of the pre-Easter COVID drama, as far as low inquiry, and then he's mitigated the landlord's loss by covering her expenses. So that was a perfect situation of a standard break lease working out, and hopefully he gets to come back to Australia soon and will rent something else off of us. So right, that's for the vast example. Majority of break lease cases, it's business as usual.
But that's a standard clause, right? We're talking about what about because this clause I thought was specifically COVID related as well, or is it?
Yeah. So my memory is that it limits it to 1 week's rent compensation, and that only applies if tenants are able to substantiate they've lost 75% or more of their income.
Yeah, right. Okay, so that's a bit of an extreme case. Basically, you said, look, you know, if you only need to pay up 1 week of rent, if you can demonstrate that you've taken a 75% damage to your income, to your normal income, that's when you only have to pay 1 week rent. Otherwise, standard basically break lease procedures will apply, like what you have just described with your other tenant, where they still have to cover and agree on an amount that's up to the end of the lease, plus potentially letting fee and cleaning fee and all that. In other words, you know, bringing the property back to the normal standard before you can you can get it let it out again.
Just quickly, something you just brought to my attention there too. My understanding is that the 75% loss includes income from job seeker and job keeper. So if you're entitled to either of those, that's considered in part of the 75% loss. So for example, if you were earning $1,000 a week net and you're now receiving $550, you've only had a 45% loss in income.
Interesting. Cool. All right. Well, I think that gives us a good roundup in terms of what has happened with the Queensland Tenancy Protection reforms, and just confirm those have pretty much been legislated now, right, Tom?
Yes, absolutely. All in effect. Yeah.
They're all in effect now.
As of 2 weeks ago.
Okay. good. So it's a timely, so it's basically a timely update in that sense, so that everyone is aware and the Queensland landlords at least is aware. It's a lot fair for both sides. And, you know, as REIQ have been pushing for everyone to say, you know, it needs to be catering for everyone. And I'm glad that I know a lot of our listeners have reached out to me and say they have put through that campaign as per REIQ's instructions. So thank you all for who has done that, and clearly that we're now seeing a difference in terms of the outcome. You know, leveling.
Absolutely.
The
Fabulous result.
Yeah, I've got a quick question, Tom. Do you see once this whole situation clears up with the coronavirus and things start to open back up, do you see a permanent sort of a pause on rental increases? That it will more be it heading more towards rents reducing a little bit over the long run in the next few years than increasing?
This is a really good question and a loaded question, and one that I'll give a crack at giving my opinion on, but we would need so many more qualified people to answer it.
Yeah.
If we look at the evidence right now, prior to Easter, things looked really bleak. Market confidence is downhill where cases are increasing. Post-Easter, they lifted the first restriction. Cases started to decrease. Transmission rate of under one. We very quickly came back to what's pretty close to pre-COVID for me as far as leasing. We're now relisting properties at or very close to the rents that they were previously, which when I spoke to you guys a month ago was not the case. So I guess on one hand, I'm a bit disappointed that we took such serious measures previously expecting this to be worse, but it's exciting to think that it's bounced back so quickly. That, I guess, that sort of consumer confidence and the like will change, I would think, if we have a new spike in cases, which I guess is the government's biggest fear. And I do have some trust in them that they're going to make good policy that to ensure that that doesn't happen, because whether it be for the rental market, the stock market, the general economy, consumer confidence is key, and this bouncing up and down is what kills consumer confidence. So fingers crossed they do a great job of that. In that case, we have at this stage returned near enough to normal as far as rents and vacancy times, and would hopefully continue to do so. If that's the case, there's no reason to think that the rents would depress or decrease or stay stagnant for a long period. But then if we start looking to the medium and long term, then we start looking at longer term economic effects of this whole situation. And although I'm not qualified in that those sorts of matters, I am concerned globally, actually. I was going to say nationally, but even globally, we might see some pretty flat property markets. There's been some great discussion on Property Chat recently about that, actually. I was watching some people discuss, and some people who are much more clever than me with those sorts of things. Anyone who watches that should go and have a peek. I'll see if I can find that link. But, yeah, I think as a direct result of this now, no. But as a overall economic effect, potentially, just yes. There's probably a good possibility that we'll have limited growth.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. It feels like that we may be headed towards a little bit of a deflationary situation here in the near future, it feels like, which means, especially with the commercial, to be honest, commercial definitely. Residential is a mixed bag right now. It's hard to say that it will happen, but I just don't see how, especially I think, I don't know, David, whether you read the article or not, but they're talking about no salary rises for teachers.
Yep.
And this was in New South Wales, right? I have the article on me right now, but which is sort of stagflation or even deflation to some.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how it will impact the rent or the actually residential sector will be very interesting. But yeah, it was good to get your thoughts, Tom, definitely on this, like always. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you both for your time.
No, it's all good. And we'll probably see you again soon in near future once this situation clears out a little bit and there's more data available to see what direction are we heading in. But to our listeners,
hopefully more good news, more stability.
Yeah.
And we need to bring him back on for another Logan argument. Logan update, mate.
Yeah. No. Thanks for that, mate. And if listeners want to get in touch with you, we'll put your, well, they can email us and we can forward you the email, or we'll put your email address in the notes somewhere. Thanks for being on the show. And to our listeners, if you guys are enjoying the content, please don't forget to give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. And let the word spread like a fire, spark your fire. Cheers.
If you have any questions or feedback about today's episode, you can reach out to us through sparkyourfirepodcast@gmail.com. That's sparkyourfirepodcast, all one word, @gmail.com. Also, the content discussed in this episode is general in nature. Please seek specific advice from qualified professionals in regards to your personal situation.